We should play a game on what are the top things that are not normal that they perceive normal. Like, no, it is not normal to sleep 3 hours a night every night.
It is not normal to go 3 days before you sleep 3 hours a night.
No, it is not normal to intermittently fast all of your breakfasts and lunch and only have one meal a day always.
It is not normal to vomit every time you see food.
Yes. No, it is not normal to have to highly depend on your sunglasses just to go outside every single time.
Uh-oh. I'm seeing it. Getting home. So there's a lot of things, again, that you guys have been doing for so long that you have come to think it is normal.
Yeah.
It is not normal. Hi, I'm Dr. Charlene Godet. I am one of the founders of Resiliency Brain Health.
And I am Dr. Michelle Eisenman, and I work at Resiliency Brain Health.
Doctors, thank you very much for joining us today. Resiliency Brain Health certainly come across my social media a lot after you were visited by Cody Alford and Michael Block. You know, two people that I've spoken to in the past and one that I can, you know, call a friend. The work that you've done for those two, you know, being veterans, has been absolutely amazing. I know you deal with, you know, civilians as well, but when it comes to TBIs and chronic pain that veterans come accustomed to from years of active service, especially in special operations, you know, you do some incredible, amazing things. So if you won't mind, let's start with the process of how people get in touch and then the initial sort of phases that they'll go through for you, you know, diagnosis.
So we work with a lot of nonprofits. You can see in the background, we have a couple of flags here, but oftentimes we're contacted by the veteran themselves, and oftentimes we're contacted by the nonprofit groups that fund. So if a nonprofit group calls and funds, they've already done their due diligence. They've already, you know, made sure that this person fits into their mission statement. And most of the time they've had a diagnosis already of TBI and often PTS as well. It's not required for them to come through, but oftentimes they've already had that by the time they do. If the veteran contacts us directly, we spend a little time, generally Jay spends a little time on the phone with them, trying to figure out, you know, when they served and, you know, what they're looking for, you know, did they have any diagnoses? And then we can pair them with one of the nonprofits that we work with. And then that nonprofit has the opportunity to decide, yes, in fact, they're in the mission or not the mission. So we try to help that way as well. So once all of that's been decided and we've determined that, yes, in fact, they're a good fit for the program, we start sending them paperwork because everybody loves paperwork. So they fill out some pretty extensive paperwork for us. And that really gives us a better understanding of, in fact, can we help this person or are we not the right clinic? We don't want to waste anyone's time or money flying into Texas to have, you know, therapy if we really aren't going to be able to help them. So after they fill that out, Dr. Eisenman and I, we do what's called a medical review, look over everything, and then hand them back off. Yes, in fact, we can help this person. Jay, get them scheduled. Or I call the nonprofits and say, hey, listen, I think there's a better place out there. We're going to refer them out. Okay. And so once that happens, they get on the schedule. So this is a little process, you know. Then they are on the schedule, they fly in. The nonprofits have areas around here where they have Airbnbs and they have hotels and things like that they put them up in. And then they come in for an intensive 2-week in-clinic part of their therapy. And so while they're here, we do a lot of testing, we do a lot of therapy. And then at the end, we retest because we want to see what types of improvements we've made in that 2 weeks. And that second round of testing helps us determine what their next 6-month plan at home is going to be. So we're continuing to work with these guys and gals for the next 6 months. And then then we go from there. We decide what's the next step after that point.
So let's just break that down a bit, taking it to the beginning of that. Obviously, working with a lot of nonprofits, you know, if you were going to take this on by yourself, I would imagine there's quite a cost involved. So obviously, these nonprofits are funding the veterans. Am I right in thinking that?
Correct. Mm-hmm.
So going through this extensive paperwork, what sort of typical questions are you looking for when it comes to that?
Good. Well, some of the traditional ones, like past medical history is involved, like current list of medications. And then we have the more extensive part of our paperwork, which then includes more of a specific metabolic and neurologic form. So we just break down questions relating to different functions of the brain, which can help us as we do the medical review determine what are the primary areas of concern? And then we pair that with their metabolic assessment that then tells us what are the organ systems that are of primary concern. And then we pair that with their past medical history, their current list of review of systems, and their current complaints. So that's kind of the paperwork that they have to fill out. But because it's so extensive, we have a very good idea as to what direction we're going to take our history and that exam for.
One of the things that, you know, the veteran that's filling this paperwork out, they have to be 100% honest when it comes to filling it out. And obviously, you know, especially in the special forces community, there's a lot of stigma for admitting certain things are wrong with yourself. So obviously having that honesty in this paperwork to start off with is incredibly vital. I'm right on that.
Yeah. And saves a lot of time.
Yeah.
Right. It's not hard to tell who's not being honest.
Yeah.
When we get the paperwork back and we see, you know, there's a rating system 1 to 5 or whichever part of the paperwork it is. And if there's zeros on everything, then the question is, well, then you don't really need to be here because it doesn't appear anything's wrong. Right.
Yeah.
So sometimes they have to fill out more than once to be able to be honest with themselves. Sometimes it's relatives that help, you know,
yeah.
A wife, a husband, a friend that says, hey, man, no, you really haven't slept in 3 days. Sleep is a problem for you. Well, your perception of it being a problem is different because you haven't slept in so long. No longer do you find it to be a problem. It's just where you are at this point. So sometimes it's honesty that they just don't honestly think about it being an issue anymore because they've dealt with it for so long.
Yeah. Obviously, you know, if you've come to the part of the process where you're actually having a nonprofit intervene on your behalf and, you know, contact yourself and there's some financial cost involved, obviously at this point that we're hoping that the veteran is going to be, you know, honest with himself and yourself for filling out these forms and wanting the help and realizing that there is a problem with some point of aspect of his life, his mental health or perhaps a physical injury. With TBI still being very new in the military world and something that isn't readily diagnosed, how does that come across from the perhaps the VA or the medical risk history from the military itself? Is it difficult to start predetermining causes at this stage?
Generally, in their initial intake, we ask in there anything that they perceive to have been an accident, right? We get a lot of, from the pilots, we get the hard landings. Doesn't matter if the copter rolled over 3 times and you know, disintegrated, it was just a hard landing. Paratroopers, you know, with
yeah.
the jumps, that was a hard landing, you know. We've had...
never crashes, though.
Yeah, that's never the word. We can read between the lines oftentimes and to help ask more questions. We've had the opportunity to work with enough of you guys at this point that we recognize some of the terminology and the hard landings and the slight bump in a Humvee or, you know, some of the other really great creative ways that you guys, that the guys just describe things. So they don't actually have to have a TBI diagnosis. When they come in, we can take history, we can take their exam, and then we can do all the diagnostic testing. We can see how the brain is functioning and performing, and we can, you know, come up with a diagnosis as needed.
Yeah, and sometimes they'll be they'll write if they did have a loss of consciousness or not. It's not required to have a concussion to have a loss of consciousness. But when they do write it first, then it's easy to kind of just, you know, go through that. But a quick caveat to people that may be listening, oh, I didn't have a loss of consciousness. Well, I'm not sure you would remember if you lost consciousness for 3 seconds. So I wouldn't blame you. So I just wouldn't use that as a qualifier.
So one of the biggest skills I'm sensing at the moment is being able to read the lines of, you know, the words of the operators, of the veterans, of when they're filling these forms out, and deciphering a military language and a terminology that's used to make things sound just a little bit more fluffy and less dangerous.
Correct. Fluffy, I like it.
Fluffy is a good term. Yeah.
That's exactly how I would describe Cody and Mike. Fluffy.
So once the veterans arrive at your clinic, what's the first line of testing that you're doing them, depending on what you think the diagnosis is? What's the first line?
For diagnosis? Mm-hmm. Well, definitely we want to look at their eye movements. So objective testing, because we have our bedside examination, which is more, part of it can be objective and part of it is subjective. But our most objective testing is going to be things that have metrics that we can actually do comparison pre and post that say numerically what's changed and what hasn't. Number one being eye movements. And the reason for that, I don't know. Okay, so a lot of people have a hard time pairing that together until I say this, like, hey, remember on TV when someone's playing football and they get a concussion or appear to be concussed and you get taken out in the sidelines and someone's like, can you see this? Can you see this? And so all of a sudden that clicks for people on why eyes have a relationship. But eye movements, directionality of movement and operation really gives us an insight to see what areas of the brain may be functioning appropriately versus inappropriately. Balance is a huge one that we do because the brain is in relation to systems, and these systems need to function in a specific way for even bodily functions such as fluids to be able to function well and appropriately. And then a cognitive assessment that kind of gives us more cognitive processing speeds, such as executive function, verbal visual memory, cognitive flexibility. So can you switch from a task of this conversation to that one? Psychomotor speed. So, you know, if we're playing a game of catch, how well can Dr. Godet and I hold a conversation while we do motor activity? And so that is more extensive as well. And then that just gets paired with everything else that we've done to see, okay, this is what we have going, and this is the benchmark, the starting point.
And they also have, before they come in, they've had their labs drawn.
Yeah.
So we have their metabolic parts as well that we're going to assess while they're here.
You also look at hormonal levels as well when it comes to perhaps testosterone and estrogen levels within the body.
Absolutely. So we look at all the systems, your normal CBC, chem profile that most of your docs run when you go in. But then we also run a lot of inflammatory markers. We need to see where the inflammation is. Is it in the veins, in the tissue? Where do we have inflammation? We need to see what the hormones are. Your brain will not heal if your hormones aren't regulated. So hormone dysregulation is a really big one as well. And we need to make sure that you're making the right hormones, right? One of the things that we see that's very common is men after a head injury will stop producing as much testosterone and they're producing more estrogen, whereas women will start producing a lot of testosterone and very little estrogen. So they're aromatizing, right? And so we need to make sure that for a healthy brain, men are producing what they need, women are producing what they need.
So looking at this first stage, it seems to be very non-technology-based testing. You're looking at the person for their physiological conditioning, their reactions, their balance, and then you're obviously looking at the blood works, the chemical side of the body. So I find that very fascinating, that it's almost a very back to basics as soon as you've got this veteran, this person in your clinic. So I quite like that it's a very basic but thorough investigation to start off with. Obviously, I imagine there's still a lot of technology and equipment later on that they get to, but having that cognitive and motor responses must be very important to the next phase of the testing to find out what's wrong.
One of the best things I think about testing is when you're in the middle of it, you get to see where strengths and weaknesses are, right? So when you're doing a balance test, you know before you step off that balance plate pretty much what your test is, what it's going to reveal. I mean, you were there. You had the opportunity to understand when you just really were having challenges. Same thing for the eye tracking test. When you're unable to follow a target and you're trying to explain to me why you can't read paperwork or why you can't read comics that you used to read, or why you can't read your kids a story at night when they're going to bed, it makes a lot of sense, right? You're there. You know exactly what that test is going to tell me before I even walk into the room, which is nice. I think the cognitive test, which I always tell people, it's not an IQ test, right? This is completely how fast does your brain process information. So once you see it, once you hear it, understand and process out, how fast is that? Because that's where the concussion part really shows, right? And so then when you come out of that test, and you'll have to ask those two about it, how much they loved it, both times they took it. There's generally some conversation, not in a nice way, about God, I hate that test, because you get to see where your true challenges are. So for us, it's good because patients already know, hey, listen, I'm in the right place. I really do have some issues. Even if I didn't fill it out in my paperwork, I can see that there's stuff going on with me.
Yeah, and the observation of like bringing it back to basics is very good, because one of the things that happens after a concussion or a TBI is, well, when your brain or your cortical areas are not functioning as well, if you think about it neurodevelopmentally, like you wouldn't really judge a kid for, taking a whole year to learn how to walk. But in a way, that's kind of what's happening with your brain is, it sustained an injury and you do have to go back to basics and maybe learn a few things here or there so that the functions can work more appropriately. So, because I think like something that happens a lot because of the CNSVS or the cognitive assessment, they're like, oh, well, this is saying I'm not smart. Just like in the balance assessment, some guys will say like, well, I am strong. Like, and we've had some guys that are very, you can see muscles chiseled, but for what we're testing, it appears like there's a lack of strength in certain areas that may be more due to activation. So it definitely is a back to basics, but it by no means necessary means that you guys aren't smart or strong.
Obviously, when we say back to basics, like you say, it's just the areas and how things are being tested. What's the time frame for these tests then? Because obviously you said, the person's there for 2 weeks. Is this the first couple of days, the first week itself before you start looking at how to try and improve on these things? Because obviously you said, these first tests are your baseline to make sure that you're going to be working in the right area, and you test it again later on to see that there's improvement. So at what stage during these 2 weeks do you start actually working on trying to fix the issues that the veteran would have?
So on that very first day when they come in, it's about an hour for us to take the additional any additional history that we didn't get in the paperwork and do their physical exam. It takes about an hour. Then we send them over and they start the test that we talked about, the eyes, the balance, and the cognitive. And that's about 2 hours worth of testing. And then they generally get about, I don't know, 15, 20 minute break. And then we send them over to the gym. And at the gym, they do more functional movement assessment testing. So that whole first day is a whole lot of testing.
A lot.
Okay. And most of the time, even for the people that have had a hard time sleeping, most people after that full day of testing go back and take at least a 2 hour nap. Most of them report day two, hey, I slept really well last night and I took a nap, right? So day one, all testing. Day two, we start therapy. By day two, Dr. Eisenman and I, on Mondays when all the guys come in, guys and gals come in, right? That's our intake day. Monday night, we sit down and go over everything and we put their plans together. So Tuesday morning when they walk in, we already have a plan for them. We already know what we're going to be doing over the next 2 weeks. And so Tuesday morning, we say, here, this is what we saw. This is what we found. We go over all of that with them. They get to see all the diagnostics. They get to see how they did, ask questions, bring in a second set of ears if they want to call a wife or a friend or a spouse and have somebody else listening, or even in clinic if that's, what they've chosen to do. And so after they have the opportunity to ask all questions, everything's answered, we start therapy right then.
Wow,
So day
that's
two is exhausting as well.
The first week is very like tiresome. And the treatment plans are dynamic. So if we like we'll talk and we'll put it set forth, but if we're going through the day and we know that there's something, hey, this person may actually need more of this, we were wrong in our original thinking, we will modify the treatment plan.
So it's very fluid as you're going along on those 2 weeks then. Obviously, you're saying it's very tired, very stressful for the veteran, for the patient in these first couple of days. What about for yourselves, having this testing and then having to turn around an action plan for this 2 weeks in a short period of time for yourselves? I mean, how tiring is it for yourself in these 2 days?
I'll tell you, Mondays are tiring.
I think
Those
we've
are our
been
long days.
tag teaming for a while now that I feel like I don't know. Like she sometimes just does a and I'm like, it meant A, B to the left and right. And so, you know what I mean? So I think we do get tired, but I think that we have been, and there are certain things that do become more, what's the word I'm looking for? That just shows up often. So I think we've just gotten better at categorizing, like almost like a decision-making tree. If this, then that. If that, then this. And so we get tired, but I think that as we go, it just becomes more refined. And so we're like, here you go, here you go, here you go. Okay,
Mondays are exhausting.
done.
We're usually here late on Mondays.
I'm not trying to put that down either. It's not that we're not tired.
But you know what's really interesting is, there are only so many therapies out there that you can do with a patient, right? But you may have two patients in here at the same time doing the same type of therapy for two different reasons. One of the best ones I like to talk about is whole body vibration. Okay, there's a lot of great research on whole body vibration. So you can use it to help somebody's lymphatic system start to flow. So if they're having edema and swelling and things like that, we can put them on lymphatic, right? There's also a setting on that same piece of equipment to improve GI function. Good research that shows if we can activate the bacteria in the gut to start to produce vitamin B12 and serotonin, then our patients are going to improve. So we can put someone else on that same therapy at a different vibration rate for something different. Third one would be sensory into the feet, right? So you may see three different guys go on to the vibration platform at three different vibrations for three different reasons, right? But it's in all of their treatment plan. So everybody doesn't do the same thing and no one does it for the same reasons, but they all do similar therapies.
It's interesting that you mentioned obviously whole body vibration. Having these new sorts of treatments, these new techniques, we wouldn't have thought about that 10, 15 years ago when it comes to treatment of veterans. And obviously things are constantly moving forward. How do you decide? Is it just through medical journals and proof that's already out there that you take these methods, these new pieces of equipment, and use them? Or is there a different, are you trialing them yourselves to find results?
All of the above.
So between the numerous conferences that we go to, and we're reading research all the time, for multiple reasons, right? We have to have that. And then just having conversations with colleagues in our field. When we see somebody put something out on social media, then we want to find out about it. Or you know, a company contacts us and says, hey, what do you guys think about my product? And they may send something here. Dr. Eisenman is the best guinea pig ever. She tests a lot of stuff.
That's why I don't feel bad sometimes when they're like, oh, I didn't like this one. Well, let me tell you.
So it's definitely, so we try to stay current. It's not about always having the latest and greatest. We want to make sure before we bring something in here that it's actually going to be beneficial to the patients, because we are contacted a lot about a lot of different devices, and we've had the opportunity to actually do research on some of them. And, you know, if they're not beneficial, we're just not going to keep it. It may be, you know, great and showy, but it doesn't help a lot. We're just not going to put it in.
Yeah. And this program is a great foundational, you know, starting point to kind of pivot in a direction that you want to heal, but it's not the only program out there. So, you know, should there be some kind of therapy that they would benefit more with a more frequency of, or, you know, long lasting, you know, that they can do long term, then we're probably more willing to refer out for that therapy and just only spend time with something here that we know can give, you know, the quickest result for what we're looking for.
When it comes to the cognitive and perhaps memory side of treatments, do you find the veterans end up having flashbacks and remembering things from deployments that they've perhaps forgotten, sometimes in a good way, sometimes in a bad way? How do you, if that does happen, how do you deal with that at that time? Because it might be a bad memory that triggers them down a path, or it might even be a good memory that they've forgotten about. Obviously, two different scenarios, but have you come across that, and, you know, how do you deal with that situation?
So one of the things that when we ask everyone what their goals are, because I can want a lot of things, but if my goals for you and my abilities to help you are not matching your goals, we have to see if we can get those to match closer, right? So if somebody comes in with a goal of improving memory, that's a conversation day one that we have. What is it that you're wanting? Do you have support? Do you already have a counselor back home? Do you have psychiatrists? What do you have for support? Because, and that is the conversation, memories come back. I don't get to choose what memories those are, and neither do you. And so I want to make sure that you're supported before we take that trip together, because I want to make sure that you don't get yourself into a place that's not positive. So we try to head that right in the beginning, making sure everybody does have support.
That's very good. Obviously, when it comes to the more physical elements of things like TBIs, how do you go about, obviously, because you know, you took these baseline measurements, what else do you do to help improve the conditions that they may be suffering, especially from TBI? What is it that you do to improve it?
We have some passive therapies, but we have a lot of active therapies. Vestibular rehab is huge for us. For those listening that don't know what vestibular is, it's those little ear canals that you have that kind of give you position sense against gravity. Everyone looks at it like the snail or the cochlea. It's more in depth. And so the communication of that visual training movement, strength,
partnering, super stronger.
Yeah, partnered with Semper Stronger. So Rebecca Rouse and Joel Del Rosario are fantastic when it comes to strength and performance. And then we do a lot of cognitive, we do chiropractic care as well. So should they need more manual therapy. But it really is just a plan that kind of stacks with each other because these systems don't work independently of each other. They work together. And so as we work on a system, maybe it's balance and vestibular, then we'll fortify that with sensation and vibration, and then we'll fortify that with proprioception and adjustment, then we'll fortify that with visual training. And so that's kind of how those therapies go.
So partnering with Semper Stronger has been really beneficial for us.
Yeah.
So after the guys finish neurotherapy, then we send them over to the gym and then they get to work part of that out. So when I say they're tired, they're mentally tired and hopefully they're physically tired. I think Rebecca does a really good
I'm
job
gonna
with
say something.
that.
It's like I'm gonna know if she saw this podcast if I get a text message after this. But they'll refer as the evil babysitter sometimes.
By the sounds of it, her workouts could be quite strenuous then.
Yeah. We did go back and check in on them though, so making sure they're all alive. No.
So having this workout that Rebecca sort of gives them, is this part of the ongoing 6 months that you're staying in touch with them? Because obviously United States being such a big place, and these people might be from any of the states. So keeping in touch with them and keeping this process going, if they didn't have the equipment that you have, or there wasn't a place close to them that has the equipment you have, is it purely just looking at the sort of the physical aspects of it, perhaps doing memory challenges and keeping their physical health to a certain level? Is that what you sort of look at over these 6 months?
So we write a neuro program for them at home, and we send them if there's any special equipment, which is there generally isn't a lot. We send it with them when they go. What I don't want is people to go home and do all of their homework on a computer, right? Getting them away from the computer is part of what we do. So because everybody between work and family and stuff, you already have time committed to phones and computers and things like that. So we don't need to give you a lot more. And I know a lot of our colleagues send people home with a lot of apps and things like that. And we just don't for that
Yeah.
exact reason. Everybody already has too much screen time. We don't need to add to it. So we try to incorporate their homework into daily activities. And then Rebecca does actually have an app, so she can monitor how often they're checking in. So they can do her program from home. They do not need a lot of equipment. I think a band and a kettlebell is the max equipment they need to be able to do her program. So we try to be very responsible when we're planning these things so that the guys and gals aren't having to go out and buy a bunch of stuff. They just need to integrate this into life.
Yeah, something that she taught us way back when was too that, like, should the lights go out and we have no electricity, we can still do therapy. So we're not dependent on any equipment to actually get the activation that we want to see in the brain. And we've had that tested out because we did work in a location that did lose power for a day for because of
Often.
weather concerns. And all the guys are like, "All right, I guess we're done for the day." And we're like, "No, actually, we can still do quite a bit." And they still got the same amount of therapy. They were still wiped out. So much like she said, because of that, even though we have a lot of equipment that helps facilitate our ability to see more people, you don't need to have this equipment at home to continue building on your progress.
When you're coming to the end of these 2 weeks and you're retesting again, are they surprised with the amount of progress that they've made over these 2 weeks? And how much does it affect them emotionally to see this progress? And do you too get emotionally invested in these 2 weeks?
Yes, we do.
It's very hard not to because you spend like 2 hours a day with the person. You get to know them very well.
Yeah. So when we talk about time, Dr. Eisman has a patient one-on-one for 2 hours. I have a patient one-on-one for 2 hours. And so this is one of the few places that you'll ever get 2 hours of doctor-patient contact. So there are 20 hours that they get with us over the next 2 weeks, right? That's a lot of contact, good or bad. That's a lot of contact for them. The second week is what we call the week of negotiation. So generally come back in on that second Monday and they're like, doc, you know, I noticed some things over the weekend, right? And we re-up, hey, what are the new goals for this week? You know, did we reach the goals you wanted last week? How are the goals for this week, right? And then we set some new goals with them. And they're generally surprised at how well they're doing that very next Monday. And so then the negotiation starts. So doc, do you think I should stay 2 or 3 more weeks? Doc, you know, and what we share with them is by the end of this week, your brain is going to be so tired. You're going to be so happy that you're going home. I promise you, right? Your brain can't take another week of this. And we do that purposefully, right? We take them right up to that point. But on the Fridays that the guys and gals are exiting, there's generally a lot of tears, right? There's tears when they see the start to finish diagnostics because they are surprised that their brain can start to change that quickly.
Yeah.
And then there's a level of anger that generally comes in that if you could do this in 2 weeks, why have I been waiting 10 years? Why hasn't anyone else helped me? Right. So then we have a lot of conversations about doctors and their lane. When we start looking at different doctors, they all have different lanes and you may just not have made it to the right one. And that's part of the challenge. And that helps opening that looking forward going, hey, listen, as we go out, these are some of the things of continuation of care that we think you're going to need. And these are some of the practitioners you're going to see, right? So there is a lot of emotionality on both sides because for us, it's beautiful. We know where they came in. And sometimes they're on the red line when they come in, right? We're really concerned with the nonprofit calls and they say, hey, listen, you have to take another one in this week. We're not sure that he's going to make it longer if you don't get him in now, right? So we tried to be very cognizant of that. But so there's a lot of emotion on both sides when we see that people are healing and they're happy and they're moving. And then we get that call in a week or 2 weeks that they've reintegrated, they've been home and they're integrating back into their family and their wives are able to say, hey, listen, I really thought you were going to really be reactive when the kids spilled milk all over the kitchen and you kind of laughed and just helped us clean it up. That was a big change, right? Mm-hmm. So we love hearing that. Yeah. And we love seeing it.
Yeah, I agree.
When you say, obviously, there's veterans that, like you said, refer to you that could be very close to doing something quite drastic, quite final. I'd imagine that they've been through a process already. They've been through the VA. They've perhaps been just heavily medicated for a period of time. They've lost their hope with the VA. They've gone to an association and they've come to you. That time period itself must be, you know, years after perhaps leaving the military, the event itself. It must be difficult for yourself taking that on board, knowing that they've been through that sort of journey and there is a certain risk involved that they've already made that decision what they're going to do with their life. Am I right in thinking that, not knowing too much about the American healthcare system, that the pharmaceutical companies are perhaps financed some perhaps hospitals, perhaps some VAs, because it seems to be, from my perspective, very business-like when it comes to American healthcare. Is that right from my understanding?
Yeah, you know, American healthcare, we have something, Dr. Eisen and I call SOC, right, which is standard of care. And we call it SOC medicine because that's about as good as it is, right? You are, as a medical provider, required to do certain things. If someone comes in and says X, you're required to do Y, right? So there has become a time where doctors' hands are becoming more tied. You come in with labs and your lab doesn't show this elevation. However, you had this cardiac event, therefore you're going to be put on this medication, even if it's not beneficial to you, right? And so if they don't do what's called standard of care, then they're in jeopardy of losing their license. So unless all of these docs come together and say, okay, we're done with that, right? As a collective group of doctors, we're not doing that crap anymore. You know, it's not going to change. And that's where the frustration comes in. And that's what happens at the VA as well, right? The average life expectancy of a doctor or career expectancy at the VA is about 2 years. Most of the guys, each time they go in, they see a new doctor. So there's no continuation of care. There's no ability to have trust. There's no ability to build trust because you're not seeing the same person each time. So the VA it's a broken system. It really is. And it's unfortunate because they have the ability to be amazing. It's just not.
Yeah. And then there's just a dual sided challenge because the standard of care is a big issue. If you're a person or a practitioner that has the volition to want to do more, but then you're also looking at the other side, you know, doctors are people too. And so maybe that's not a very good person that you're dealing with and that you don't really get to know that or know that person in their personal life either. You know what they're like, because they hang up that coat and then go home and they're just a regular person.
Absolutely. So, although, you know, some people, you know, we can slate the VA. However, it seems to be a lot better over in the United States for veterans than it here is in the UK. There's a lot more foundations, a lot more startups. There is obviously the VA for veterans and, you know, wonderful foundations like yourselves that help veterans. It does seem to be that little bit better in the United States for veterans than it does here in the UK. And also the ability for veterans to open up and actually talk about their experiences. US veterans seem to do that a lot better than our special forces veterans for some strange reason. So I feel the UK is still behind the US in quite a lot of respects when it comes to, the care for its veterans. When I've spoken to a few other veterans, they've also looked at, and I'd like your opinion on this, taking hallucinogenics like ayahuasca and ketamine as a form of therapy. Obviously, I know that's not what you're about at Resiliency Brown Health. What's your thoughts of that swim lane when it comes to helping people with mental health?
You know, I think there's a lot of good research that's coming out about a lot of that. There are some good groups that nonprofits that are coming out doing the data collection, doing the research. So I think that if those things, again, like you said, that's not within our scope. It's not what we do. But if you're doing that in a controlled environment, right, because it is a psychedelic, right? And so things you need to be in a controlled environment, making sure that the negatives don't happen, right? So if they do that, there's a lot of groups out there that are collecting data on that so they can show, hey, look, this is what we're seeing. This is the improvements that we're getting in these young men. I think done much like anything else in a combination with other things, I think you're gonna see some really great improvements over a period of time. Can you do too much? Absolutely. So one of the things you have to be cautious with your group, right? The veteran group, they tend to have the more is better. So again, controlled environment is going to be a better environment to do these things with, because more is not always better when it comes to things like this, right?
No. And obviously, never recommend self-medication when it comes to anything like that. That's, you know, something that you need to leave to the professionals. What does the future look like for Resiliency Brain Health? And where do you see yourself going over the next 5 years?
Well, it's fun that you just asked that. We just bought a new building. So we are moving into a bigger space. We're excited about that. We are collaborating with other clinics in a couple of other states. Who are trying to do some of the same things that we're doing. So we are trying to give them guidance on, hey, this is what we did and how we did it, and this is what our program looks like. There are, how many would you say are in the States right now?
Oh, God, I don't know.
There are, I'd say, a couple of dozen clinics similar to ours throughout the U.S., You have some that specialize only in pediatrics.
Yeah.
You have some that specialize only in sports. We tend to have a huge veteran population. So congruency throughout that is a little challenging because you have to have people that want to work with a certain population, right? We don't do pediatrics at all. It's just not our population. So I think that as we continue to grow and we are able to continue to help with any of the nonprofits that want to help with the veterans here, and we've had veterans from across the pond where you're at, and we've had some from Canada. We're not unfamiliar with some of the things that you guys are dealing with. We've had some Polish veterans in as well. So, you know, it's one of those where we don't want to get so big that we can't continue to offer this one-on-one type care. So we would rather help other people open clinics and have more out there than get so large that this becomes standard of care.
Well put. What about the spouses and partners of the people you help? Do you give them any advice on perhaps how to deal with what we call like secondary PTSD, where, you know, walking on eggshell syndrome, they've been afraid to say the wrong thing, drop something, and send their partner into a state? Do you offer advice for them as part of the process?
You know, as we're bringing counseling on, we hope to be able to do that more. We've just recently brought counselors on into the program. So as far as that goes, I think that they'll be able to help with that.
Yeah.
From our end, if the spouse is involved in their day one or their exit day, that gives us that opportunity.
Yeah, because there's a huge issue with HIPAA consenting as well. Mm-hmm. So we need to have permission from them mm-hmm. to even speak to their spouse about it.
That's at U.S. Medicine.
Yeah.
So that is one of our hindering challenges. If they put their spouse on the phone and we do this together, that generally does come up and we do have the opportunity to talk. If a spouse calls in, the patient has to have signed a waiver saying I can talk to them before I have a conversation. So if that's been done, happy to do it, right?
Yeah.
So there's a few hangups, but yes, we would love to be able to have more to offer to the families as we grow a bit.
And we do have some pre-recorded videos that don't go specifically per person, so we're not disclosing any personal information from any individual, but they go into a deeper dive as to some of these functional deficits or functional issues they may have that they're welcome to watch with their spouse or partner should they want to get a better understanding. So that's, I guess, something we do provide.
Does that help them open up a little bit more as well and perhaps be more honest when talking to you about what they may be suffering with or feel that they're lacking?
Yeah, you know, we call it day three. On day three, that's when all the honesty usually comes out. Day one is all testing. Day two is hitting therapy hard. And when they come in on day three, they're feeling something different already.
Yeah.
So it's a surprise. So that's, they start to open up. That's when we hear about some of the things that weren't in the paperwork. And we call those OBTW. Oh, by the way, doc, did I tell you? Right. And it's generally, no, man, you didn't tell me. And you know, you didn't tell me.
And that makes more sense now
because you said, oh, by the way. So, yeah. So once the freedom and for them to start to have those conversations and that trust, it takes a couple of days to build that trust. We have a little bit because, you know, somebody referred them in that they knew and that person is better. And they're like, you got to go to this place. These docs, they may be able to help you. So there's a little bit that we get from that, right? Of trust. I mean, they came into the clinic, so we already leveled up right there. We know that there's a layer. But day three is when we get a little bit more.
What would be your advice to a veteran who's perhaps watching this, perhaps looked at your website, seen you on social media, and thinking about making that step and contacting you? What would be your advice to them?
Okay, first and foremost, Don't be afraid by what you look online, because for a while we didn't have a big social presence online. And so people would come in knowing nothing. And we still have some people that come in knowing nothing, but as our presence online has grown, because we need it, honestly, because if not, no one knows about us. I think there's a fear that I'm starting to see coming in on like, well, it worked for them. I don't know if it's going to work for me. Well, I don't know. I don't know if this is me or, what could you do for me? So, like, just don't be afraid. It's, you don't have to compare yourself to, Joe Blow down the road and Bob on the corner. It's just you and us, and we're just going to see where you are at. That's it.
Do you find that perhaps it's difficult that some US veterans almost get a celebrity status after they've left the military? Do you think that other veterans sort of look at that and, really do compare themselves to it, think you put that person on a pedestal and think, well, how can I compare my life to them? When they suddenly start getting that social media presence, when they start having their own branding out there. Do you think that other veterans find that difficult?
Absolutely. Yeah.
We have treated Medal of Honor recipients. We've treated amputees. And they tend to receive a lot more because of those things, right? For whatever reason. It's the guys that, don't have a missing limb or haven't, don't have disfiguration from a burn or a gunshot wound or, something that tend to get kind of left to sit over here and say, well, there are people that are worse than me. And you know what? There is. There's always going to be somebody that's out there that's not as good, but there's going to be a lot of somebodies out there that are better. So it's not that you don't deserve it. You are as deserving as anyone else. You did what you signed up for a job, you did your job, and now you have an injury. And that injury you deserve to have help with. And it doesn't have to be something that, everybody can see. It's still an injury. And that is one of the biggest challenges with TBI, is because people can't see it, we hear a lot, well, you look fine to me. Well, you know what? You don't even know what that means, right? What does looking fine, what does that really
Yeah.
mean?
I think it
So,
comes back to that honesty portion
yeah.
too. Because I think the more honest they are with themselves, that's when they can see, okay, he may be missing a limb, but I still have struggles with sleep. So I think the more honest they become, the more willing they are to really get work done here.
Do you think you could almost put that under the umbrella of perhaps survivor's guilt because they don't have a physical injury, so to speak, that they almost feel less of an injured person because it's mental, it's TBI, it's something that you can't see. Do you think you could put that under that umbrella?
I think so. And I think it often is because it's not talked about enough. If more people understood what a TBI was, if you came in and you said, man, I've got this big bruise on my thigh, right? I was lifting weights, I dropped something on my leg, I've got this giant bruise. Everybody would look at it and go, hey, listen, that's serious. Have you had that checked out? Right? But because they can't see that bruise in your brain, it's not thought of the same, right? So traumatic brain injury has a physical, a metabolic, and a mental part to it. Anybody that's been chronically ill, there's a mental challenge that goes with just feeling bad all the time. But is TBI a mental issue? No, right? Does it have a component? Absolutely. Is there a metabolic? Yes, your labs are going to change after a brain injury, right? They're going to change. So is this partially a metabolic issue? Well, yeah, but that's not what it 100% is. So when you look at somebody and we start to talk about TBI, when we do testing, one of the tests we actually do on that cognitive test is that PTS form that you guys fill out everywhere you go, right? Because our goal is to show that when we help someone with TBI, their PTS will in fact get better. but only a small amount because there are only about five symptoms that overlap. So treating somebody's PTS will not fix their TBI. Will their TBI get better? Well, yeah, there's five symptoms that overlap. So it may get a little bit better, but it didn't fix it, right? And so these two things often happen together, but you have to treat both separately to get that person back to where they need to be.
One of the things I probably want veterans to realize is that the TBI can also be accumulative than just a single incident where you've been knocked unconscious, head injury. There's also all the training explosives, breaches syndrome. It can be accumulative and not just a single event. I'm right in that, would you say?
100%. So the big term for the day is sequela, right? It means that you had an injury, it didn't heal, you received another injury, so now it's leveled up, right? So now you have a sequela of events that are going on, and that first one still hasn't healed, right? So these subsequent ones haven't either. And so that becomes a big issue with any, you know, civilian or veteran that comes in. And oftentimes it will be the small one that really perplexes someone because, hey, you know what? I went to war and I had all these explosions and these blast injuries. And, you know, yeah, I lost vision for 3 or 4 minutes and I was nauseous and I had a headache for the next 2 years. But I just bumped my head on my kid's head. And now I can't even get off the couch. My world is spinning. Well, it was cumulative. All of these, and this little thing is what you're thinking was the big issue, and it's not, but that was finally that trigger, that tipping point where your brain's like, look, man, I can't do this anymore. You gotta get some help here.
And I think that's the advice we should give everyone. You need to seek professional help. Don't ignore it. Don't lie to yourself. Be honest and open of your symptoms, your issues that you're having, your thoughts, your feelings. Talk about it, especially with you two. I think, you know, who wouldn't want to talk to you two? What a wonderful sense of humor you two have come across on this interview, and how passionate you've been about helping people. I think it's been absolutely fantastic. Is there anything you want to leave us with? Any further words of advice that you'd give to people?
We should play a game on what are the top things that are not normal that they perceive normal. Like, no, it is not normal to sleep 3 hours a night every night.
It is not normal to go 3 days before you sleep 3 hours a night.
No, it is not normal to intermittently fast all of your breakfasts and lunch and only have one meal a day always.
It is not normal to vomit every time you see food.
Yes. No, it is not normal to have to highly depend on your sunglasses just to go outside every single time.
Uh-oh. I'm seeing it. Hitting home. So there's a lot of things, again, that you guys have been doing for so long that you have come to think it is normal.
Yeah.
It is not normal. It is not normal to smell, to walk around going, do you smell that? And everybody to look at you and go, smell what? Right? That's not normal either.
Yes.
And it's not normal to have a headache for 2 years.
No.
So there are a lot of things that you guys have come to think it's just normal, and it's not. Pain changes someone's perception. Pain changes personalities, right? It's a chronic issue. TBI is a chronic issue.
It's also not normal to not poop every day. So just for the GI ones out there. Or five times in a day. So that's not normal. So extremes are bad, okay? So
all good conversations end with poop right there.
Absolutely. And I've also learned that maybe I should leave my sunglasses at home on occasion then.
No. Light sensitivity is real.
Hence the baseball cap inside. Thank you very much for coming on the show. It's been absolutely brilliant putting a face to the wonderful work that you do. Thank you very much indeed. I'm going to put contact details, your website details, and links to your socials in the description for the video and also on Spotify. Thank you very much indeed for coming on. It's been absolutely informative. It's been a pleasure. And please continue with the wonderful work that you're doing. And from the bottom of my heart, thank you for helping the veterans as you do.
Absolutely. Thank you. Look forward to seeing you soon, Dan.
Maybe.
Hey, Texas is a nice place to visit, just so you know.
Well, it's on my list for perhaps moving to, so you never know.
All right.
Okay.
All right.
Well, thank you
so
very
much
indeed. Thank you.
Thank you.